This is Jeff Blankfort welcoming you to the April 25th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Donald Trump didn't invent the concept of fake news, although he certainly has popularized it, using the term to describe anything in the national media that has cast him in an unfavorable light, regardless of whether it's fact or fiction. Of course, the issuance of fake news by our government to justify wars and interventions from Vietnam to Iraq, from the Dominican Republic to Grenada, they number in the hundreds going back to the earliest days of our country. It should come as no surprise. All governments engage in the production of fake news, the United States particularly, since it emerged unscathed as a dominant superpower after World War II, arguably more than most. On every one of those occasions, the national media has played a major role in getting the public to support the government's actions. Over the last several years, but particularly so since the election of Donald Trump, on certain key issues, the media appears to be a step or two ahead of the government. Consortium News is one online website that has consistently challenged the arguably fake news that has become standard fare of the mainstream media and all the TV news networks. Those two combined have helped reignite the Cold War and have taken the country to the threshold of what may yet become another devastating shooting war. Joe Loria, a seasoned foreign correspondent and regular contributor to Consortium News, has recently taken over the helm of the news site following the death of its founder, award-winning journalist Robert Perry, who you heard a number of times on Takes on the World. At 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking with Joe Loria in Washington about the state of the U.S. media today, about the importance of alternative news sources, and particularly about the coverage of Russiagate and the war in Syria. Loria was my guest last December 13th, during which we discussed a disturbing article he had written for Consortium News, quote, "How Russiagate Rationalizes Censorship," end quote. In the article, he described how even liberal organizations dedicated to press freedom, like Fairness and Accuracy in Media and the American Civil Liberties Union, had succumbed to the heat of the moment and legitimized the censorship of anyone challenging the basis for blaming the Russians and Vladimir Putin personally for Trump's election. "The Russiagate hysteria," he wrote December 4th, "has spread beyond simply a strategy for neutralizing Donald Trump or even removing him from office into an excuse for stifling U.S. dissent that challenges the new Cold War," end quote. That was from Joe Loria, who I'll be talking with at 20 minutes past the hour. What makes what he will have to say particularly timely was the announcement last Friday that the Democratic National Committee, headed by party insider Tom Perez, had filed a suit against Russia, WikiLeaks, and the Trump campaign for meddling in the 2016 presidential election. When I first saw the story, I thought it was a joke, that the Democratic National Committee would really want to raise the issue of the 20,000 internal DNC emails plus the thousands of messages taken from the computer of John Podesta, Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign chair. I found bewildering. Those emails, after all, exposed the conniving of the DNC to deny Bernie Sanders the party's nomination and revealed Hillary Clinton telling the bankers at Goldman Sachs that she could say one thing to corporation folks, but then something else to the voters. Quite apart from the fact that three intelligence agencies concluded, but could not prove, that the emails had been hacked by the Russians, the Democratic National Committee chair Tom Perez, with this lawsuit, seemed to be sending a message to the Sanders supporters, who have been engaged in making the party more responsible to the needs of the people, that nothing has really changed within the Democratic Party hierarchy. On my last program, I mentioned to my guest Gareth Porter that the word alleged had apparently disappeared from the vocabulary employed by mainstream as well as many self-styled alternative media hosts when it comes to actions that may or may not have been committed by Russia or Syria. Not being present on the ground, they are forced to rely on smartphone reports from witnesses who may or may not have specific agendas that would raise questions about the accuracy of their reports. This is particularly true in Syria, where an NGO operating in territory held by Islamic jihadists, namely the White Helmets, is funded by Britain, the U.S., and nations in the Persian Gulf, opposed to the Syrian government and its ally Iran. The latest example of this phenomenon was, we are told, without any direct evidence, was a chlorine gas attack by the Syrian government on Douma, a Damascus suburb long held by jihadists who have been shelling civilian areas of the capital controlled by the government. The lack of evidence did not stop President Trump, in concert with France's President Emmanuel Macron and British Prime Minister Theresa May, from carrying out a bombing on what they claimed, without any proof, were Syrian chemical weapons and research facilities outside of Damascus. The three heads of state apparently could not wait for international chemical weapons inspectors to arrive and determine what exactly had happened in Douma. In the nationally televised press conference in which they described the attack, neither Defense Secretary James Mattis nor head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford, mentioned, nor were they asked by members of the press in attendance, about the potential dangers to the surrounding civilian population if indeed the buildings targeted actually contained dangerous weapon-grade chemicals. There was one intrepid British journalist, however, Robert Fisk, who shuns press briefings, and chose to go to Douma and find out for himself and his readers of the Independent of London what had happened there. You may have heard Fisk in the past on Democracy Now! And on Takes on the World a little more than a decade ago when I interviewed him in his seafront Beirut. Fisk had been based in Beirut since 1975 and thus is the dean of all Middle East correspondents. Since you are not likely to hear what he found in Douma or read his story anywhere else, I am going to quote from it at length. Quote, "This is the story of a town called Douma," this story begins, "a ravaged, stinking place of smashed apartment blocks and of an underground clinic whose images of suffering allowed three of the Western world's most powerful nations to bomb Syria last week. There's even a friendly doctor in a green coat who, when I track him down in the very same clinic, cheerfully tells me that the gas videotape, which horrified the world, despite all the doubters, is perfectly genuine." War stories, however, have a habit of growing darker, Fisk continues. For the same 58-year-old senior Syrian doctor then adds something profoundly uncomfortable. The patients, he says, were overcome not by gas, but by oxygen starvation in the rubbish-filled tunnels and basements in which they lived, on a night of wind and heavy shelling that stirred up a dust storm. As Dr. Assam Rahabiani announces this extraordinary conclusion, it is worth observing that he is, by his own admission, not an eyewitness himself, and as he speaks good English, he refers twice to the jihadi gunmen of Jaish al-Islam, the Army of Islam, in Douma as terrorists, the regime's word for their enemies and a term used by many people across Syria. Am I hearing this right, wonders Fisk? Which version of events are we to believe? By bad luck, too, he writes, the doctors who were on duty that night on 7 April were all in Damascus giving evidence to a chemical weapons inquiry, which will be attempting to provide a definitive answer to that question in the coming weeks. France, meanwhile, has said it is proof, quote, proof, chemical weapons were used, and U.S. media have quoted sources saying urine and blood tests showed this, too. The World Health Organization has said its partners on the ground treated 500 patients, quote, exhibiting signs and symptoms consistent with exposure to toxic chemicals, unquote. Fisk then notes that inspectors from the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW, were at the time blocked from coming to the site of the alleged gas attacks themselves, ostensibly because they lacked the correct UN permits. But before we go any further, Fisk goes on, readers should be aware that this is not the only story in Douma. There are many people I talked to, he says, amid the ruins of the town who said that they had never believed in gas stories, which were unusually put about, they claim, by the armed Islamist groups. These particular jihadis survived under a blizzard of shellfire by living in other people's homes and in vast wide tunnels with underground roads carved through the living rock by prisoners with pickaxes on three levels beneath the town. So the story of Douma is thus not just a story of gas, or no gas, as the case may be, points out Fisk. It's about thousands of people who did not opt for evacuation from Douma on buses that left last week alongside the gunmen with whom they had to live like troglodytes for months in order to survive. I walked across this town quite freely yesterday without soldier, policeman, or minder to haunt my footsteps, he writes. Just two Syrian friends, a camera, and a notebook. Happy to see foreigners among them, happier still the siege is finally over, they are mostly smiling. Those whose faces you can see, of course, because a surprising number of Douma's women wear a full-length black hijab. I first drove into Douma as part of an escorted convoy of journalists, he writes. But once a boring general had announced outside a Rec Council house, "I have no information," I just walked away. It was a short walk to Dr. Rahabiani, who told him, quote, "I was with my family in the basement of my home 300 meters from where here on the night, but all the doctors know what happened. There was a lot of shelling by government forces, and aircraft were always over Douma at night. But on this night, there was wind and huge dust clouds began to come into the basements and cellars where people lived. People began to arrive here suffering from hypoxia, oxygen loss. Then someone at the door, a white helmet, shouted, 'Gas!' and a panic began. People started throwing water over each other." Yes, the video was filmed here. It is genuine, Dr. Rahabiani told Fisk. But what you see are people suffering from hypoxia, not gas poisoning. The white helmets, write Fisk, the medical first responders, already legendary in the West, but with some interesting corners to their own story, played a familiar role during the battles. They are partly funded by the Foreign Office, and most of the local offices were staffed by Douma men. "I found their wrecked offices not far from Dr. Rahabiani's clinic," writes Fisk. "A gas mask had been left outside a food container with one eyepiece pierced, and a pile of dirty military camouflage uniforms lay inside one room." "Planted, I ask myself," said Fisk. "I doubt it," he writes, referring to, if not confirming, accusations that the White Helmets are ally with the jihadists. The place, he notes, was heaped with capsules, broken medical equipment, and files, bedding, and mattresses. "Of course you must hear their side of the story, but it will not happen here," adds Fisk. A woman told us that every member of the White Helmets in Douma abandoned their main headquarters and chose to take the government-organized and Russian-protected buses to the rebel province in Idlib, with the armed groups with which the final truce was agreed. Again, my earnest questions about gas were met with what seemed genuine perplexity. "How could it be," Fisk asked, "that Douma refugees who had reached camps in Turkey were already describing a gas attack which no one in Douma today seemed to recall? It did occur to me, once I was walking for more than a mile through these wretched prisoner groin tunnels, that the citizens of Douma lived so isolated from each other for so long that news, in our sense of the word, simply had no meaning to them." Syria, concludes Fisk, doesn't cut it as a Jeffersonian democracy, as I cynically like to tell my Arab colleagues, and it is indeed a ruthless dictatorship, but that couldn't cow these people, happy to see foreigners among them, from reacting with a few words of truth. End quote. Those are the words of Robert Fisk, the Vienna Middle East journalist, writing in the Independent of London about his trip to Douma. They tell a very different story from what you have read or heard anywhere else. As for the White Helmets, subject of an Oscar-winning documentary and much heralded in the U.S. and the West, British Foreign Minister Boris Johnson can be seen on a YouTube praising the group and bragging that the UK has given it £32 million as part of a larger $65 million package, which includes money from the USAID to international development. Corroborating what Fisk found, reporter Pearson Sharp of One America News, a conservative Christian TV network and supporter of President Trump, interviewed doctors and witnesses at the clinic, which can be viewed on YouTube. They also said that there was no chemical attack and that the strangers came into the clinic, shouted gas, and then filmed the reaction. Bringing you news from such respected sources as Robert Fisk, as well as others that you've never heard about, the challenge which to believe by the mainstream media has been one of my objectives since Takes on the World first went on the air in 2001, and what you just heard is just one example. There is an off-again, on-again report that Russia is about to send the S-300 defense missile system to Syria in the wake of Israeli and Western attacks on Syrian military bases, and that there will be catastrophic consequences for any nation's air force that launches an attack on those bases. In response, Israel's Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman told Israel's Ynet News that, quote, "One thing should be clear, if someone fires on our planes, we will destroy them. What's important to us is that the weapons defense system that the Russians transfer to Syria are not used against us, meaning, of course, that Israel should be able to attack other countries with impunity, which it has done since it became a state." Last Friday marked the fourth week the Palestinians in Gaza began nonviolent protests near the Israeli border, demanding an end to the decade-long siege by Israel and a right to return to their Palestinian homeland from which they or their families were expelled in 1948. An estimated 10,000 Palestinians, the same number as the previous Friday, showed up. Arrayed against them on the other side of the fence, as on three previous Fridays, was a row of Israeli snipers, their rifles rested on a berm, ready to shoot, absolutely no danger from any Palestinian. In those four Fridays, they have killed 39 protesters, none of whom were armed, and wounded several thousand more, according to medical reporters on the ground. This time, one of the four killed was a 14-year-old boy who was shown in photos standing with friends when gunned down. The White House has made no comment on the protests since April 6th, when Jason Greenblatt, President Trump's Middle East envoy and an unabashed supporter of Israel, warned Palestinians to stay 500 meters away from the border fence while condemning leaders and protesters, quote, who call for violence or who send protesters, including children, to the fence, knowing they may be injured or killed, end quote. None of what their soldiers have been doing in Gaza have bothered most Israelis, and certainly not the country's political leadership. But the same cannot be said of the reaction to the refusal of Jerusalem-born actress Natalie Portman to come to Israel to accept a $2 million Genesis Prize Award, what they refer to as the Jewish Nobel. According to Portman's representatives, recent events in Israel have been extremely distressing to her, and she does not feel comfortable participating in any public events in Israel, and that she, quote, cannot in good conscience move forward with the ceremony, end quote. Needless to say, the response in Israel to her statement of conscience has been, with but a handful of exceptions, vitriolic, with one Israeli official saying she should lose her Israeli citizenship. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.